This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, March 28th of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, Colorado's prisons are dangerously understaffed. That's according to a new report. We'll speak to one of the authors. The Biden administration has announced land and water protections, plus its Ocean Climate Action Plan. That story and more on This Week in Water. And we'll go to our comment line to hear what's on the minds of listeners. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth? On today's KGNU Science Show, host Beth Bennett focuses on new science teaching methods under development at CU Boulder. At 9 a.m., tune in for another archival recording of British philosopher Alan Watts. Then at 9:30, Greg Schultz will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still ahead, but first, it's time for headlines with KGNU's John Kellen.
Colorado lawmakers are on the brink of passing two major pieces of gun safety legislation, with two more edging closer. A bill that would raise the age to legally buy a firearm to 21, and another that would impose a three-day waiting period before a gun purchase can be completed, passed two key obstacles yesterday. The age limit bill passed a formal vote in the State House of Representatives, while the waiting period bill passed a voice vote, with the formal vote still to come. With a Democratic majority, approval seems likely. Once that happens, both measures will go to Governor Jared Polis to be signed into law. Two additional bills passed the House over the weekend. One of them would expand Colorado's red flag law, while the other would make it easier to sue gun makers. Lawmakers still have to reconcile the differences between the Senate and House versions, but that's expected to happen without difficulty. A gun safety group praised lawmakers for passing those two bills. A spokesperson with the Giffords Law Center said in a press release that it's critical that victims of gun violence are able to hold the gun industry accountable. At the same time, new litigation against the company that made the firearm used in the massacre at a Boulder King Supers 2 years ago is expected to be filed this week. KGNU's Stacey Johnson has more.
The lawsuit by relatives of five of the victims accuses Connecticut-based Sturm, Ruger & Company of marketing its AR-556 pistol in a reckless and immoral way that highlighted the weapon's ability to kill. The alleged shooter bought the AR-556 legally. Under federal law, gun makers are generally protected from liability, but there's an exception for how weapons are marketed. Another lawsuit brought by the son of a sixth King Super shooting victim was filed on March 14th and on the same grounds. The Associated Press says these lawsuits are similar to a lawsuit against gunmaker Remington by relatives of the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting victims. That lawsuit was settled last year for $73 million. Last week marked the second anniversary of the King Super shooting, in which 10 people were killed. For KGNU, I'm Stacey Johnson.
It could be another 1 to 2 months before the investigation into the Marshall Mesa fire is completed and its results made public. It's been nearly 15 months since that disaster. Speaking at a public forum recently, Boulder County Sheriff Curtis Johnson said that every time it looks like investigators are done, they find a new area to look into. More than 1,000 homes and commercial structures were destroyed, and two people died in the December 30th, 2021 wildfire. With damages at more than $2 billion, it's the most destructive fire in Colorado history. Meanwhile, a state-sponsored drilling project is underway to determine the extent of subsurface coal fires burning in abandoned mines beneath the Marshall Mesa area. Those underground fires have burned for decades, according to a spokesperson with Boulder Open Space and Mountain Parks. The Daily Camera says the Colorado Division of Reclamation, Mining, and Safety is developing a 3D model of the area and a mitigation strategy. The properties involved are southeast of Marshall Road and Colorado 93. More than 15,000 Coloradans have died from the COVID-19 pandemic. That's twice as many Coloradans who died in the 1918 flu pandemic and makes it the single deadliest event in state history. The first reported COVID death in Colorado was in March of 2020 in Colorado Springs. When the statistics are adjusted for age and comorbidities, Colorado had the fifth most COVID deaths nationwide. Water straight from the tap in Boulder homes met federal and state standards in 2022. That's according to an annual report released by the city at the end of last week. The report also said that the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment has the city on a less frequent monitoring schedule for lead and copper. Testing for those metals now occurs every 3 years because the city has had low levels over time. Boulder was, however, cited for violating the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment's backflow prevention rule. The report said it was not an emergency and did not pose a threat to public health. Backflow is when water flows in reverse from properties back into the city's drinking water system, creating potential health problems. A new round of applications for e-bike rebate vouchers begins in Denver today. Income-qualified residents and those with a disability can save up to $300 on a standard e-bike or up to $500 on a cargo e-bike. Eligible Denver residents can apply starting at 11 a.m. at denverclimaterebates.com. Vouchers become available every other month and can only be used at participating bike shops. The Denverite says that in the previous round of availability, all 860 e-bike rebates were claimed within 20 minutes. In Boulder, it's going to cost more to park a car in certain downtown areas beginning next week. City officials say hourly rates for on-street parking in high-demand areas are going up by 50 cents. The city is also moving toward performance-based pricing, which sets different rates for on-street parking based on demand. Rates for handicapped accessible parking and City of Boulder parking garages will remain the same. In today's weather outlook, mostly sunny and warmer throughout the Denver metro area. Expect a high temperature of 53 degrees in Denver, 47 in Boulder, 45 in Fort Collins, a bit colder up in Nederland with a high temperature of 38 degrees. For KGNU, I'm John Kellen.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Colorado's prison system is in crisis. That's according to a new report out from the Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition. The report details how overtime has increased as prison staffing levels have plummeted. This comes as the state government plans to expand prison capacity by 400 beds. Joining me live is Christy Donner, Executive Director and Founder of the Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you're headed to the state capitol today to speak with lawmakers. Why?
Well, today the state budget bill for next year will be introduced. It will be over $1 billion for the Department of Corrections for the first time in state history, and includes funding for over 700 additional beds in the face of this staffing crisis. And so we're extremely concerned about that. We're concerned that lawmakers aren't connecting dots sufficiently to understand the depth of the staffing crisis. So just to continue to add additional beds and not manage the prison population is quite irresponsible.
Okay, so that's 700 beds, not just 400. The report that your organization put out last week details a steep drop in staffing levels in Colorado prisons and a corresponding increase in overtime worked by the staffers who remain. Many people may assume this is due to the pandemic, but some of the charts in the report show staffing levels did dip in 2020, but then really dropped off in 2021. What happened there?
Well, probably a confluence, right? I think the pandemic absolutely had an impact on staffing, but the overall economy has also really, really changed as we've kind of grown out of some of the worst effects of the pandemic. You know, we're running a 3% unemployment rate statewide, so there's enormous competition for staff across the private and public sectors. And so I think there are higher paying law enforcement agencies, other departments of corrections. I think there's incredible competition in the private sector. And I think the Department of Corrections has very unique hiring challenges by virtue of the job. Not everyone wants to work in the Department of Corrections. And the labor pool that's available in a lot of the rural communities where these prisons are located is tapped. So I think it's a confluence of factors, but it's not temporary. And that's what we are trying to urge legislators because they've been trying to address the staffing crisis primarily by increasing funding to the Department of Corrections for improving, you know, compensation and hiring and retention bonuses, which we actually don't have an objection with. It's just a fool's errand, as far as we're concerned. There's a limit to what the department can do. We're not faulting the department for a lot of the scramble that they're trying to do to hire. They're working very, very aggressively. But it's just not the economy that we have. And so we're faced with upwards of 1,600 vacancies within the Department of Corrections, 20 over a quarter of the entire workforce. And some of the strategies DOC has had to do is been very concerning, particularly what you mentioned with the overtime. The overtime has skyrocketed, more than doubled, right? And that's not sustainable over time. They're also moving a lot of the program staff. So your teachers and your vocational trainers and all of that are now doing security posts, which has had a devastating impact on the availability of prison programming. So we're just warehousing people. And then probably most concerning is that they've lowered hiring and training standards. So they lowered the hiring age from 21 to 18 and also reduced the basic training academy down to 14 days. So all of that says to us that this is a department that is really in crisis. And I don't know that the General Assembly is connecting all those dots when they're just continuing to add more beds. They added the 400 beds in February to the current budget adjustment, which is called a supplemental bill that passed. So this is 700 more beds on top of the 400 beds that they just approved, with no real assurance that the department is going to be able to hire that staff. So it's sort of a train wreck about to happen.
I want to loop back to something that you said in that response, that it's not just prison guards. The staffing levels are actually very low among medical staff and social workers. So what are some concrete examples of the consequences of not having enough staff to run medical programs and social work programs at correctional facilities?
Well, people are not getting critical care, right? So we know that, and particularly, you know, we have to understand this in the context of this is a department that also just went through a pandemic, and the hellscape that was inside the department for both incarcerated people and staff, right? We have people that have long COVID. So it's not even just kind of a normal need for medical care. And so we have seen people with delays getting access to care, extensive delays in getting access to care. And we also know that this is a population that the majority of whom have histories of mental illness and substance abuse disorder. So it's a very high need population for the very type of clinical services that are not available and this has been a chronic problem within the department way before the pandemic in trying to staff up on the clinical side for many of the same reasons that I just mentioned. But it's even harder because all of Colorado, right, is struggling to have the clinical workforce that we need.
There was something that stood out to me in your report that, for example, there was a woman who had to take parenting classes in order to be eligible for parole, but those classes had not been offered for more than a year and a half. So are we also seeing cases of people who would in theory or on paper be eligible for parole being unable to meet the criteria for parole?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the major reasons why the parole board will deny somebody parole. Either they have a history of, you know, bad institutional conduct or whatever. They don't have an adequate parole plan or they haven't completed prison programming. And so as you have seen the dismantling of programs inside the facilities, then you'll see that rationale for denying parole increase. We have case managers that are now doing, you know, security posts. They're not helping with parole release planning and stuff like that. And so it's the tiger chasing its tail, right? And that's why we're saying that the General Assembly just can't throw money at the problem in terms of assuming that the DOC has magical powers, that they can restore all of these vacancies and, build back the prison programming. We have to be doing the other side of the equation, which is doing management of the population itself.
And on that note, what are some concrete recommendations that your organization is making to state lawmakers?
Well, in the short run, there was legislation that was passed in 2018 when we were in a similar crisis, but it was because the bed vacancy rate was very low. And there was obviously conversation about opening up more prison beds and all of that kind of stuff. And there was a sort of a compromise or a two-prong approach that was approved, which was to add the beds. But then there was also legislation called the Prison Population Management Measures legislation that was introduced that said when the DOC prison bed vacancy was 3% or less, which is when it gets in sort of the red zone for the department, that there were proactive steps that needed to be taken to try and identify people who would be good candidates for release to either parole or community corrections and sort of expedite those considerations. So it's not mandating that people be released. It's just a philosophy that says we need to pay attention when the Department of Corrections is in crisis and be proactive. So, but in 2018, we didn't contemplate that there would be a staffing crisis. So there is no mechanism in the prison population management measures that triggers when the staffing vacancy gets to a critical level. And so we have to, so that's what we're asking legislators, right, is to consider, and we talked with Senator President Fenberg yesterday to say, hey, would you approve a late bill to so that we can make amendments to the prison population management members to account for our current reality, which is we don't have a crisis because of bed vacancies as much as we do with the staffing vacancies. So let us have a trigger for managing the population when the staffing ratio is so low, because those two things have to align, the number of people in prison and the staffing ratio. There has to be alignment with that so that prisons can operate. And we're completely out of alignment right now.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Christy Donner is the executive director and founder of the Colorado Criminal Justice Reform Coalition. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Yes, thank you.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Up next is This Week in Water.
Everything, everywhere, all at once. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Yes, it's the name of an award-winning movie, but according to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, it's also what the world needs now for climate action. He made his remarks as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released what they called their final warning on the climate crisis.
The report says that human-caused global warming has already led to widespread and rapid changes in the ocean and the atmosphere, affecting weather extremes in every region.
The scientists say vulnerable communities, which have historically contributed the least to current climate change, are disproportionately affected.
Yet they say there's still some hope. Global temperatures are currently around 1.1 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But if greenhouse gas emissions are limited as soon as possible and then reduced, we might avoid the worst calamities that would occur if we reach 1.5 degrees.
However, experts say we are likely to go above that level in the 2030s, which could lead to tipping points that can't be stopped, like the melting of permafrost that would release more greenhouse gases.
The report also warns that what we don't do today to lower global warming will affect our planet for thousands of years. If temperatures go up to 2 degrees Celsius and above, the Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets may be irreversibly lost.
This past week, the Biden administration took steps toward protecting the ocean and land, starting with the establishment of two new monuments, the Aviquaame National Monument in Nevada and the Castner Range National Monument in Texas.
In Nevada, the move would prevent development on 500,000 acres and create one of the largest contiguous areas of protected wildlife in the U.S. The Kastner Range designation in Texas protects more than 6,000 acres near El Paso that was formerly a military training and testing site.
The administration also announced its Ocean Climate Action Plan, which in part directs the Secretary of Commerce to consider designating additional marine sanctuary areas around the Pacific remote islands southwest of Hawaii to protect 30% of the nation's ocean.
Overall goals of the plan include achieving carbon neutrality, using the oceans to store greenhouse gases, and helping communities to become resilient. Biden's priorities will include such efforts as boosting offshore wind and decarbonizing ships.
However, in terms of protecting marine environments, Rob Steiner, a marine biologist retired from the University of Alaska, wrote in The Hill that the most pressing ocean conservation imperative is not only remote Pacific regions, but also much closer, along the continental shelf, where waters are heavily exploited, degraded, and at risk of further decline.
Ever turn on a porch light at night and suddenly see swarms of insects? If there happened to be a caterpillar munching on a leaf nearby, you just outed them and made them vulnerable to predators.
That's the conclusion of researchers at Cornell University in a recent study about artificial light and its impact on wildlife. In this case, two moth caterpillars that live in New Hampshire.
The scientists created caterpillar models from green clay that resembled two of the insects commonly found in the forest. The material was soft enough that if predators like insects or birds tried to take a bite, it would leave a mark.
Of the over 500 clay caterpillars they glued to leaves and then subjected to the equivalent of a streetlight, nearly half showed predatory visits during the summer-long study, about 30% more than ones in the dark.
Not good for the critters, which are the most vulnerable at their larval stage and already facing threats from habitat loss, pesticides, invasive species, and climate change.
Many nocturnal animals, from migratory birds to sea turtles, are also thrown off. So the researchers say, do nature a favor. Don't leave the light on.
And finally, there are drinks you can make by just adding water. Instant coffee, hot chocolate, Kool-Aid, and beer? Yeah, beer.
The Nicella Brewery near Munich, Germany has launched a powdered beer they say is kinder to the planet.
Since beer is mostly water, not having to transport bottles will reduce its weight by 90%. That will lower the carbon footprint of shipping the lager, which is currently being tested in small quantities.
The brewery's managing director said, given inflation, the energy crisis, and a glass shortage, it made no sense to import bottles, fill them with German water, and then export them around the world.
To imbibe the dry beer, just mix a couple of spoonfuls of their powder into water and stir. It will develop a real head of foam, is carbonated, and tastes like a lager you ordered on tap.
Minus the alcohol. This initial product is dry in more ways than one, but if they attract investors, the company plans to roll out an alcoholic version soon.
Nicella has a record of disruption in the brewing industry, selling among its 42 different products, ones that are anti-aging, gluten-free, and a beer you can bathe in.
That's it for this week in Water. Support comes from GC Green, a veteran, woman, and Native American-owned clean energy and resilience solutions company. Learn more at gcgreen.com.
We now check in with KGNU's comment line and the listeners who share their thoughts about what they hear on KGNU.
Good morning. This is Evan Ravitz. March 22nd, Morning Magazine mistakenly said that Boulder's No Eviction Without Representation ballot initiative passed by Boulder voters in 2020 was a state law. This law, which is slowing the new wave of evictions and homelessness, was not the work of state politicians, but thanks to the Boulder Democratic Socialists of America, who collected over 3,000 signatures and convinced 59% of us to vote for it. Please give credit where it's due.
I felt that I needed to respond to this morning's Connections program. I've heard other people offer similar commentary or criticism before, but this morning, it was Friday the 24th, and I was listening to Duncan Campbell, And as he often tends to do, he kind of monopolized the full hour, it seems, or most of it. And so I see sort of two problems with this. One, it'd be nice to eliminate those technical glitches, which waste a lot of time and seems to kind of frustrate the objective of the program. And two, I understand that Duncan and Lisa are longtime friends, so they probably know each other well enough. I suspect Lisa knows what to expect. And when she did finally get a chance to speak over halfway in the program, I think it was about 9:05 or something, she spoke for quite a long time, and that's probably the only way she could get her voice heard. But I think even if they liked that kind of contest, filibuster kind of competition, where each is almost blocking the other, I would like to suggest that for our listeners, it would be a real improvement if they actually listened to each other and responded, actually had a dialogue or a conversation. It really...
We're going to have to leave it there. We go now to the BBC News headlines, and after that, we're going to have How on Earth.